The Guardian.
Have you always wanted to write a novel, a history, a short story, your epitaph? Want to know how successful authors do it? It's all in a new Guardian book. I'll tell you more at the end of this podcast.
Football Weekly Extra. Today, Premier League gets bottom handed to it. Chelsea smacked in little old shack. Fan fares for Farfan at the Emirates after Arsenal play Affoli in Ruhr Gunners clash, while Man City get blown away on Amsterdam grass. Dutch drug reference, tick. Pod reels at a midweek where Man United not getting beat by Braga was the Premier League highlight, checks out the other big scores around Europe and looks forward to some teams that Premier League sides can beat each other this weekend. Yes, there's Chelsea, Man United, Everton, Liverpool and much, much more, including post tweets and funny shirt sponsors in today's Football Weekly Extra. Hello, everybody. Crikey, how much football is there to discuss in today's Football Weekly Extra? The answer, a lot. And Barry Glendening's here to do it.
Hi. I don't have to do it all, do I?
No, you don't. Good. Barry. You don't have to do it all. Rob Smythe is on board as well.
Hello. I did my best to fob this off to John Ashdown, but he wasn't buying it.
He's joking, listeners. Also here, Michael Cox. Bad week for Michael Cox, zonal marking. Everybody cussing you out on Wednesday television. I don't like zonal marking. What's zonal marking for? Don't see the point of a zonal marking in the modern football. How'd you feel?
It was Gary Neville, wasn't it?
It was everybody.
Was it everyone?
Everybody.
Well, it's a good plug.
Graeme Souness?
He's not a fan.
No.
He thinks...
Jamie Redknapp.
Jamie Redknapp amused me on yesterday afternoon because he kept calling Hulk the Hulk every time he referred to him. I quite like that.
Yeah. Okay.
But
cool.
As for the zonal marking, I didn't see that.
You're the zonal marking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, everyone's entitled to their opinion on zonal marking. And fair enough, if people don't like it, they're always quick to blame, I don't like zonal marking. But
as long as they're not referring to Michael.
No, but if, say, a team uses man-to-man marking for a corner, no one goes, oh, I don't like man-to-man marking.
Right.
Well, Gary Neville's now the coach of England, and they considered a goal from a corner in their last game by man-to-man marking.
Right.
But presumably he didn't go into the change room and say, why are we playing man-to-man marking?
Crikey, that's a good point, Michael. Thank goodness you're along to ask pertinent questions like those. after what has been the worst midweek for Premier League sides in Europe for a decade, it says here. Is that correct? Barry, you got the stats?
Well, I don't have the stats, but wasn't there a pretty shocking week for them last season?
Yeah.
And that we were all hand-wringing and wailing.
Right.
And an English team went and won the tournament. So let's not get too carried away just yet.
All right, then. Bit of perspective. Like it. Man City, can we get carried away with them? I think we can.
We probably can.
All right. 1 point so far. Love the stat about the net worth of their starting 11 vis-a-vis the Ajax opposition. 2.7 million for Ajax's starting 11. 191 million for Man City. But, of course, they don't have much experience in playing in the Champions League, so it's wrong of us to expect them to get results. Isn't that right, Michael?
No. I mean, they had last year's experience, and the players have plenty of experience individually. It was just a poor performance. And again, for the second time, I think, this season, Mancini blamed his own poor preparation, he said. Does that word translate differently in Italy or anything? Because to say he prepared poorly or he didn't prepare enough seems a quite shocking excuse for a manager of a Champions League side.
I don't think he really means it, though. I think he says that because that's something that a good manager does.
Okay.
But equally, he qualified it at one point by saying he prepared poorly, he didn't prepare the players well, he didn't tell Julian Lescott to jump for the header.
Was he being sarcastic?
I can imagine he was. Yeah, unless Julian Lescott really does require day-to-day instructions about putting one foot in front of the other, I don't know.
It's difficult to know with some players.
It is, isn't it? But yes, this whole experience thing is a bit nonsense, as other people have pointed out. In Ajax, there's not a wealth of Champions League experience.
Yeah, this is not like the mid-90s when United and Blackburn and Arsenal went and were savaged in the European Cup because they had no experience. But I do think every City defeat has been, or every City result in Europe has been explicable in isolation. It's just the accumulation of those has now led to the point where the confidence is a bit fragile, a bit insecure. And then last night was a bad result. But apart from that, and even that is explicable when you consider what's happened to them in the last kind of 16 months. I just think they've been really unlucky with the draws, let's be honest.
They have been unlucky with the draws.
Drawing at home to Dortmund, losing away to Madrid, losing away to Napoli, these are results that can happen in isolation. The problem is the accumulation of them.
Well, that is true. It'll be interesting to see what Borussia Dortmund do when they go to Ajax. Certainly Real Madrid got a massive result there.
Yeah, you'd expect them to win, I think.
Yeah.
But I still think...
So what's your explanation then?
There isn't, well, just sometimes teams...
But you just said there was.
Well, no, sometimes teams lose and draw games, and then if you get accumulation of those, your confidence suffers, and then you get to a point where you lose a match that would have seemed unthinkable 12 months ago.
So it's a confidence problem?
I would think so. Yeah, you look at them last night, they weren't playing with any kind of confidence compared to how they played domestically.
Is that the manager's fault?
Not necessarily. Clearly he doesn't help with all his faffing and all his ideas.
Right.
But I think ultimately it's just they had a bad time last season in a way that you can understand. I mean, they've still got 10 points. Then they got off. You know, this season they could have won in Madrid, beaten drew at home to Dortmund. These are all logical results, but they kind of impinge upon your confidence.
Right, well, you say 10 points last year. This year, after the halfway mark of the group stage, they've got 1 point. And a lot of people pointing the finger at Mancho, Bobby Manc, for all his tactical tinkering, Barry.
Well, I think he played 3 different formations last night, and after the game, Micah Richards said that the players don't like playing 3 at the back. They're not used to it. They don't do it much in training, which was strange but refreshingly honest thing to hear from a player. But I kind of curious to know, Mancini said afterwards that, you know, there are 11 players on the field. They should be able to, you know, sort things out themselves. But he always seems to me on the sideline as something of a control freak. So maybe the players are afraid to sort things out themselves without being told. I just don't know. It's a sort of a half-baked theory.
In Mancini's defence, it's not uncommon in Serie A, for example, for a team to switch formation several times through the game, and a manager should expect the players to be comfortable with that. But it does seem a bit willful, the extent to which he has tinkered with what was a winning project last year.
Yeah, and he's done it in 2 consecutive away games as well in the Champions League. He did the same in Madrid when City were playing quite well and were up against Real Madrid, and then switched to a system that basically was totally unbalanced. They had no one on the right side, and 2 of Real's goals came from that side. So, I mean, switching to 3 at the back in itself is not the problem, but I'm not quite sure of the benefit. I don't really understand what he's getting out of that, to be honest.
Mm.
Manchester City fans are going to be depressed over this, but they can at least take heart that they're in a position to be really annoyed that they're doing badly in the Champions League, which is something they couldn't have dreamt of a couple of years ago. And also that Newcastle have got out of a worse pickle than this before, and Arsenal have got out of a similar
in the group
pickle.
Stages.
Yeah. Newcastle once lost 3 and went on, their first 3 and went on to qualify.
Wow.
But it's very unlikely to see that happening in a group of this nature.
Right. But in the meantime, failing spectacularly is a victory if you're Man City in a very real sense. They play Swansea City this weekend. Yes, they do. It's true. Now, meanwhile, elsewhere in the group, Borussia Dortmund beat Real Madrid. You also had Schalke ending Arsenal's terrific home record there at the Emirates in Europe. Michael, tell us more about this one.
It was just a second consecutive poor Arsenal performance. They really lack creativity. Just as against Norwich, really, there was no spark in the side. There was pace, but no creativity. The difference between Norwich and Schalke was that last night they defended very poorly as well, both as a unit and individually. Santos had a bit of a shocker at left back, didn't get any protection from Podolski ahead of him. And, it was just a poor performance. And it was ahead of the Arsenal AGM today, which tends to be Arsenal's highlight of the year these days, sadly. So it was poor timing in that respect.
Certainly was. Santos getting a brickbats, as I think they're... And I'm not entirely sure what a brickbat is, but it doesn't sound very pleasant. Never having received any myself, of course. Just one shot on target for the Gunners. Do you know, they've only had 22 in their entire group campaign in this year's Champions League. That's the fewest number of shots that any team has put together anywhere in the wide world of Champions League football.
Sterile domination.
Sterile domination. Mm. Does it reek of something worse than that, though, Michael?
Not really.
Is a team that looks all right on paper and against weaker opposition, is it actually being revealed in all its naked awfulness?
It's been an okay start to the Premier League and an okay start to the Champions League. It's just there's been 2 consecutive defeats, and just as Arsenal probably weren't going to challenge for the title a month ago, they're not going to do particularly badly.
But they're
this year.
Ninth, Michael. They're ninth. Diaby going out injured, and all that is going to be a problem, and it really is. And I suppose Wilshere coming back might make a difference, but who knows when that's going to happen. They're closer to the bottom than to the top, etc., etc. They are, in good news, facing QPR this weekend. Although, is that as easy as it looks? Because,
No, because last season, at Loftus Road, QPR turned in a fantastic performance. A performance I think was key to QPR staying up last year. And Hughes has tended to do quite well against Arsenal over the years. He's quite canny against Arsenal for some reason. Hmm. And also often tells his players to kick Arsenal as well, which helps.
Right, yeah, absolutely. And, of course, they're meeting the Gunners at a psychologically very fragile moment.
Well, neither sides are in great confidence, really. I mean, QPR have had a very poor start to the season, so it might not be a great game.
QPR have lost 10 of their last 11 Ooh. Away games in the Premier
right.
League.
Right, they haven't won away in 18 matches as well. Pressure's on both managers, I'm going to suggest there. Now, Michael, what did you make of Borussia Dortmund's performance against Real Madrid in the other game from the kind of Man City group?
Well, they're excellent. I mean, I think it'll probably be overlooked because of the disastrous results for English sides. But this was a really big game, Bundesliga champions against La Liga champions. And Dortmund were quite simply the better side. They were more organised, they attacked much better, much quicker. The real problem was Real Madrid had Essien at left back because they've got Marcelo, Contrao, and Arbeloa all out. And Dortmund basically just attacked him. Ronaldo didn't give any protection and they deserved the victory.
Well, that was a super part one. Next up, the fun continues as Chelsea Man United Hove's interview. A little look forward to that. A little look back to what these two clubs got up to midweek in Europe. Rob, how about that Shakhtar shellacking that Chelsea received Tuesday night? No. No. Don't tell me you were watching something else. Barry watched it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was probably more impressed with Shakhtar than any other side I saw this midweek.
Really? Yep.
Yeah. They were hugely impressive. Chelsea had no answers for them at all and were lucky to lose by such a narrow margin. They just got a good gubbin.
Mm. Right, well, everyone predicting doom and disaster now for Roberto Di Matteo's chances of staying in the competition, although with Juventus surprisingly drawing away to Nordsjælland or similar, they're actually still in second place and a point ahead of Juve, so might be right.
Yeah, I don't think there's any need for Chelsea to panic. I think, as Barry said, it was just a really good performance from Shakhtar. It was a lot more about Shakhtar being very, very talented and very organised, and Chelsea not at their best and maybe still looking a little bit like a side in development, whereas Shakhtar, you know, they've kept that unit at Shakhtar together pretty much the same for the last 2 or 3 years, and the difference in the attacking combinations and the familiarity was just obvious.
You can get nights like this when you are basically switching from one footballing philosophy to another and introducing a whole bunch of new players at the same time.
To a certain extent, I think it will be interesting to see the return game and whether Shakhtar can turn in another good performance. It must be said, their record this season, Shakhtar's record, they've won 100% of their home games and they're going really well in the Champions League. I think it could be quite a special year for them.
Mm. Now, Chelsea this weekend be taking on Man United at Stamford Bridge. Terrific game last season. This was the Paul Scholes game, wasn't it, Rob?
Two terrific games last season.
All right, but the one at Stamford Bridge.
Well, actually, I think the one at Old Trafford was almost better in a way.
Really?
Well, either way, it were both two great games. Yeah, kind of fixtures changed identity.
What happened at Old Trafford?
Well, United won 3-1, but Chelsea played really well. Torres missed the open goal. It could have been
that game. And then he got sent off. Was that the one?
Not that I recall.
Not that game.
But anyway.
All right, anyway. But the one at Stamford Bridge, I do remember, because that was the game when they were 3-0 down. They brought Paul Scholes on at half-time.
It might have been at 3-0. They went 3-0 down in the second half.
So oh, was probably, it in the second half?
Yeah.
Right. Clearly, I don't remember it at all. But Paul Scholes came on, and that began an extraordinary run of matches with the Scholes at the helm, in which they roared back into title contention, only to throw it all away at the death. Now, this time around, Sir Alex Ferguson's not bringing back his veteran. He's ditching them. You got Rio Ferdinand left out over his T-shirt refusal thing.
I think he was left out over his shattered, knackered body, basically.
Really?
Because he can't play three games in a week. Chelsea is such a huge game.
Right.
Would Fergie have been as contrite if he didn't have three centre-halves injured? I suspect not.
I don't know. I think Fergie got a lot of a shoeing he didn't deserve last weekend. I do think it was just a genuinely a breakdown in communication. And he's come out since and said, look, I've spoken to Rio. He's explained his position. I accept it, and
the impression,
you know, he didn't quite apologise, but then, you know, he's Fergie.
Yeah,
I think it's as near to sort of a humble apology as you're going to get from. And I don't think Rio was left out for disciplinary reasons. United have two games against Chelsea, and then is it Arsenal coming up?
He was left out simply because he can't play three games a week.
All right, fair enough.
But I'm not sure it's the end of it. Keane was on, Roy Keane was on the ITV team, and he said something like, Sir Alex Ferguson never forgets, this will come back to haunt Rio. Something like that. And if anyone will know about...
Well, he better hurry up, because he's only got 8 months left on his contract.
Yeah, but if anyone should know how ruthless Fergie can be, it's Keane. So, I don't know. I don't think we heard. With Ferguson, when you outlive your usefulness, you're gone. There's not much humanity there.
Right.
And I think that will happen to Ferdinand eventually. Right. He's done Fergie... He's annoyed Fergie a few times down the years. I suspect that might come back to trouble him.
All right. Now, what do you think, then, about Man United after surviving a massive scare against the third best team in Portugal? What do you think about their chances this weekend at Stamford Bridge?
United are such a shambles at the moment. Right. In a good way, it's really entertaining. I think I'd be loath to make too many predictions. I think there should be goals.
Mm-hmm.
I think Chelsea giving them a hiding isn't inconceivable. Mm-hmm. But it's so hard to know. I mean, basically every game United are going behind and coming back, playing some really good stuff, but only when kind of sparked into life.
Right.
So, I don't know. You would think goals. The only thing is, I think Ferguson will try and make it quite an ugly game, and will pack midfield. But despite that, I think the fact United can't
pack midfield with who?
It doesn't matter. I think he'll play three in midfield at least, and then two wingers, or maybe a diamond and a winger. So either way, I think he'll try to smother Chelsea. But United can't defend. Chelsea can't defend that well. And I think even despite that, I think there might be a fair few goals.
Ooh.
And it's changed identity. For a decade, this fixture was kind of grim and rough and ugly. I mean, the 07 Cup final was a horrible game. Two games last season were really open and entertaining, and I suspect this will be as well.
Mm, good news. Did anybody else want to pitch in on that? No?
No, it's a really hard one to call. I think if Chelsea play as well as they did against Tottenham last weekend, they will beat them easily. But will they play that well again? It's difficult to say. I'd be very impressed if they did, but I can't see it happening.
Rob, here's a stat for you. United haven't been involved in a goalless game for 73 matches. What have you got to say about that?
It reflects well on their defence.
Yes.
Well, it reflects well on their attack, obviously. The other thing that's interesting is, because they keep conceding, they've won six games after being behind already this season. Last season, I think I'm right in saying they didn't win any.
Right.
So it's kind of a good habit.
None last
habit.
Season, six already this time.
Yeah, it's kind of reminiscent of the treble team, who kind of pretty much started 1-0 down,
right,
and then 1-5-1 or whatever.
Right.
So it's kind of a good habit, but also it's a bad habit because they just start games in arrears, essentially.
Right, okay. Well, one team that certainly does know how to bounce back, that has bounce back ability, are those crazy Catalans, Barcelona, as plucky Celtic found out to their cost this Tuesday night. Sid Lowe now joins us. Sid!
Hello, James.
Hi, Sid. You sound bouncy this morning.
Do I? Oh, that's good.
Yeah, it certainly is. Hey, tell you what, it's been an interesting... do stop that, eh?
How long I could keep you going for with that.
Right. It's been an interesting midweek for the Spanish sides. Hey, let's begin with the courageous, brave Celtic and the game they so nearly got a point from on Tuesday.
Oh, brave, brave Celtic. Honestly, just before the goal, I was thinking, how long will it be before someone gives us the brave line? And then when Barcelona scored, I thought, oh, well, maybe we won't get the brave line. But then I'd forgotten the brave defeat line is even more prevalent than the brave successful line. And immediately after the game, the outro to the adverts was brave Celtic. And the intro back in from the adverts was brave Celtic. I thought Celtic were really very good. But why do we have to call them brave? What's brave about doing that?
They were brave because they're Celtic and, you know, Barcelona and stuff.
Yeah, but brave is go and take a risk, make things dangerous yourself.
Right.
You know, do something daring.
Brave. None of them cried.
Brave isn't defending for your life against Barcelona. That's logical,
right,
and it's sensible,
right,
and it's a natural product of the difference between the two teams. But it's not bloody brave, is it?
All right, then. But anyway, it was a heartbreaking defeat for brave Celtic, wasn't it? Just at the death, just when you thought they'd... They finally, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been an extraordinary night, and yet Obviously,
I would have been.
And,
you know, look, I mean, one of the things that I found the other night was lots of Celtic fans got very upset when I moaned about this Brave thing.
Yeah.
But the whole point is that actually Celtic fans should be on my side with this, because there's nothing more patronising than calling them Brave. I thought Celtic, given the limitations between the difference between the two teams, I thought Celtic played really well. I thought they limited Barcelona to, what, maybe three, four good chances, really good chances. I mean, a lot of shots. I think it was 25 or 26. A lot of shots, but relatively few chances. But Celtic defended very deep, very well. One of the things that struck me about Celtic, which they didn't do, which a lot of teams do when they're put in that position, they didn't turn cheaty and they didn't turn nasty. Hmm. Celtic were remarkably steady, I thought, in the way they defended, and largely did limit Barcelona, although there were a couple of good chances. And yeah, it would have been a brilliant result. But that's the sixth time this year that Barcelona have come back from behind, which I think tells you something about the fact that they're conceding silly goals, but also tells you something about the relentlessness with which they continue to look for the goals. And I think Celtic are, you know, we're entitled to feel like they've played really quite well.
All right, interesting. One team that didn't come back was, of course, Real Madrid, whose German nightmare continues, Sid.
I think it's 24 games that Real Madrid have played in Germany and only won one. It might be 23. I think it's 24. And actually, Mourinho after the game was saying it was one of those games where in the second half he felt that whichever team lost the ball and was caught on the break and the other side scored would lose the game. So, you know, it could be that we rob the ball off them and we catch them and we win it. But if they rob it off us and catch us, they might win it. That's sort of what happened. But I think that's overlooks the fact that at times Borussia Dortmund, I thought, were really quite impressive. It was a strange game, though. It was almost as if it was being played on one of those air hockey tables. Really, really quick. Very, very direct, but without it being long ball direct. It was very direct in the sense that every pass was very vertical. And I thought Borussia Dortmund in patches were really, really good. It wasn't a game of very much control, but it was pretty enjoyable, I thought.
Right, but there's no kind of bitter recriminations in the Spanish press this morning, then?
Not really. I mean, you know, because bear in mind that this is a game that was already being built up as it's very hard to go to Germany. It was already being built up as the fact that Borussia Dortmund are a good side and have been, you know, vastly superior to Man City, for example, in the previous game. So that was understandable. There's a little bit of recrimination in that Casillas made a mistake on the goal, although he made two or three really good saves until then. A little bit of recrimination at Michael Essien at left back, although given that Real Madrid had three players injured, the only other option was a kid called Nacho from the youth system, and I think Mourinho was probably reluctant to use him in a game of this size. But Essien was I think, found out. Also, Madrid had Sami Khedira go off quite early on, which I think affected them. But the main reason, I suppose, why there's no real recriminations is that it's probably not done Real Madrid's chances very, very much damage in terms of getting through the group. Mm. It makes it harder for them to finish first, but getting through the group, not much damage, because, of course, they had the City defeat.
Yeah, indeed so. Now, in other Spanish news in the Champions League, of course, Valencia won. And, Malaga had a slightly muted evening as they defeated Milan.
I don't know if I'd call it muted.
Well, they didn't win 4-0 for once.
No, they didn't win 4-0, but Malaga are the only side in the Champions League not to have conceded a goal so far. And that's after three games, or if you prefer, it's after five games, because they didn't concede in either of the qualifiers either. They were, I thought, far better than Milan were. Joaquin missed a penalty and then scored, and Malaga looked really, really good. 9 points out of nine, almost certainly through the group. And given the difficulties they had coming into the season, nobody expected this. The fans have gone crazy for it. The newspaper covers, obviously not in Madrid or in Barcelona, but everywhere else in Spain, are all about Malaga and this amazing adventure. And the Sheikh, who owns the club, even turned up for this game, which, to be honest, I think demonstrates that as well as having huge pockets, he's also got a neck of solid brass.
Absolutely.
But he did turn up this time and said he enjoyed himself.
Right. Does that mean he's actually going to be reopening the taps of solid gold, etc.?
Well, he said afterwards, very cautiously, I mean, he didn't really want to be pushed on it, but in Spain there's always a reporter in the director's box, and so there's always an institutional interview after the game. An institutional interview on this occasion was with the owner, and he said, "We have invested in this club and we will continue to do so." Now, of course, it's quite true, and this is one of the things that makes the whole Malaga situation so baffling, is that they have invested, and they did spend an awful lot of money, but they completely closed off that source of revenue halfway through last season. So for him to say that now is, at the very least, is interesting. But what is also true is that the people who took control of the club in the summer, and I mean took the control in literal terms, in that they took control of organising it, of arranging things, of making sure that they didn't get dragged into that situation where they were either denounced by the Spanish taxman or denounced by UEFA and put in a position where they couldn't continue competing. Those people have took a decision that even if one day the Sheikh reappears and gives them 100 million euros, they're not going to put it into something which could then cause some problems further down the track. In other words, if they were suddenly given 100 million euros, they wouldn't go and buy, say, Cristiano Ronaldo or Falcao or whatever, because at the point at which the money dries up, they then wouldn't be able to pay for that person. They need to be self-sufficient on the assumption that Mr. Sheikh doesn't give them any more cash.
Italy. Another rum week for the Italian side. Juve only got a draw. Nicholas Bentner's very unhappy there. Missed the sitter. Milan lost. No big surprises. Moving on.
Sorry, just... Yes? Bentner.
Oh, yeah.
Because a couple of weeks ago he was complaining about not getting a chance to prove himself that he really likes Juventus. And I think he described Turin as a really alternative city.
No, alternative to what?
That's what I couldn't quite figure out what he meant. But so he obviously got a chance and missed a sitter.
Well, he was on the bench to begin with. It was interesting because the DS of the club said that he was on the bench out of respect because, you know, they were playing in Denmark. So, you know, there you go. But he did come on, and it's, you know, not fair to pin the draw on him, but he did miss a reasonable chance.
The strange thing about Bentner is that Juventus have got Matri, Vucinic, Giovinco and Quagliarella, whereas Arsenal, who he's on loan from, have only really got Giroud, and then Podolski and Jovinho are better out wide. So I can't help thinking he would have got more opportunities had he stayed at Arsenal.
Right.
Whether they want him is debatable.
That might be the key issue.
But I certainly think he would be of more use at his parent club than the club he's on loan to.
Well, he's a man who scores goals when used properly, as the Danish national team can attest. Interesting. Bolton, Doogie Friedman, standing by.
Well, is he?
I think he is. Crystal Palace announced on Tuesday that he was going to Bolton. Bolton aren't quite so sure.
It seems all very on-off. And then there was speculation that possibly Ipswich might have made an approach for him.
Ipswich, who just lost...
Paul Jewell. So,
Paul Jewell.
But apparently Friedman is about to become Bolton manager.
Right, or he could go to Blackburn. That's another option, isn't it? They haven't appointed anyone yet, have they?
No.
Right.
Or he could stay where he is and finish the job like he said he would.
Finish the job like he said he would. A lot of bitter, bitter Palace fans out there.
Because Crystal Palace are in a lot of financial trouble, but they're doing well in the Championship. Bolton are...
Producer Ben's making rude sounds, almost like he doesn't want to tell this sad story. You go for it, Barry. You go for it.
And Bolton are even more financially imperiled.
Right.
And they're bottom of the table.
So. Yeah. But despite that, the departing manager, Owen Corr, feels that they are well placed to win the division. Apparently so. I might just be, you know, I might just be misinterpreting a quote that was posted hastily on Twitter, but there you go. Now, from Palace, a side who used to be sponsored by Virgin, to some teams who are sponsored by brothels in top segue news. This is from producer Ben, who wants us to talk about the, you know about the crisis in Greece. And it's hit football clubs hard. They're struggling to find sponsors. Some inventive options have been come up with, including Voukafalos, who wear pink shorts and T-shirts, emblazoned with the logo of local brothel Villa Erotica, and played a derby against Hercules, who are sponsored by All Day Bar, the escorts venue. Rob, you're nodding at that one. And it's the brothel derby. Exciting. I don't know what the score was. Yeah, it's a sub-editor's dream, this story. But they're not the only ones in Greece. You've also got... Palau Pyrgos, who signed a deal with a funeral home. Exciting, this. They play in black jerseys with the Undertaker's logo and a large white cross down the middle. And apparently this gives them a big advantage over their opponents. With one of the teams saying, in a recent match, the goalkeeper kept crossing himself. Our competitors lost every play. It seems they were too scared to come near us. Well, footballers are notoriously superstitious. A. You think of any comedy team sponsors?
Well, I know one of my favourite bands, the Super Furry Animals, once sponsored Cardiff City for a while, I think in FA Cup games or away games or something.
And one of my favourite bands, Wet Wet Wet, used to sponsor Clyde Bank.
Indeed they did, because producer Ben, ever keen to preserve the spontaneity of the show, presented us with a cut-out-and-keep guide to really, really awful shirt sponsors, which includes Clyde Bank's Wet 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 jersey. That's very nice. In at number one, he's got AC Milan, back when they were sponsored by Poo, the jeans manufacturers.
And the one I like is the one you, before we started recording, you were looking at it going, well, what's funny about this? What's funny about Inna Acetalia?
Right. But, now I get it. Now I get it. Mr. Lady sponsored FC Nuremberg. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a choice. What else?
Are any of these things worse than being sponsored by a legal loan shark or a gambling company?
Or how about when England were sponsored by National Breakdown? That was one of my favourites. But anyway, there's lots of other ones. Bimbo here for Team America in Mexico. Black Death Vodka at Scarborough. It's not really nice.
Banned in 1990, apparently.
Were they? What? Black Death Vodka. All right.
I liked it when the Scottish referees were sponsored by Specsavers. Yeah. I mean, I know that's intended irony.
Ironic.
But, yeah, quite nice, I thought.
Mm. Well, if you've got a comedy sponsor you'd like to contribute, listener, or if you'd like to be our comedy sponsor, why not? Do get in touch. Super, that's it for part two. Next up, the Premier League weekend. Tell you what, it's an interesting weekend in the Premier League. This, we've already talked about Arsenal and their clash with QPR, and of course Chelsea and Man United, but there's something interesting, there's an angle to all the rest of the fixtures. Not every day you can say that. Michael Cox, let's start with Villa Norwich. Norwich, of course, arriving on a real high after beating Arsenal. Villa, not so much.
Yeah, and I guess Norwich will be wanting to prove that Lambert made the wrong decision by jumping ship, because Norwich won last week. Villa haven't had the best start, so it could be quite a tight game.
Yeah. All right, then. Good stuff. Hey, Rob, how about the Pog Derby, Reading-Fulham?
I kind of, every time Fulham play, I just get lost in the thought of Dimitar Berbatov.
Oh, yeah?
I can't really think of anything else.
You're in a reverie, are you?
I am. Well, yeah, I mean, I suppose Fulham, they're not always great away from home. If Reading, if Reading are ever going to win a game, they right. might have a chance here.
All right. Tell you what, red and white stripes a go-go. As Stoke plays Sunderland, Barry. Is Sunderland going to be as bad as they were last weekend against Newcastle?
You would hope not, but there's every possibility. They right. could be more abject.
All right.
They beat Stoke twice last season, 4-0 and 1-0 at Britannia. So this is the corresponding fixture.
They still haven't had anybody apart from Stephen Fletcher score a goal. It's remarkable.
Denver Bass scored for them
last
season.
Yeah, but no Sunderland player apart from Stephen Fletcher scored a goal.
Yeah, I know.
Tactically, how does this one break down? Exactly. Well said, Michael.
No, it could be a terrible, terrible attritional game. Sunderland will attempt to attack ineffectively down the flanks. Stoke will be their usual sort of muscular, robust selves. And it's not a game I'd touch as a gambling medium or
really?
For a potential for 2 hours of riveting entertainment.
Were you not waving around a kind of school report, midterm report for Sunderland?
Well, I think I mentioned this on a previous pod, but there's a website called whoscored.com. It's very good, great source of stats and information. And they preview Premier League games and games from all over Europe, but they highlight teams' strengths and characteristics, or strengths and weaknesses. And for several weeks running now, Sunderland have had, this team has no discernible strengths.
Really? That's a bit lazy, isn't it? They just write, this team's got no strengths,
no, but
none.
They're right.
Really?
Going on what I've seen, yeah.
But I asked the same question that we raised on Monday. This is a team that's made signings, that has backings, that's got a highly respected manager. What's missing?
They don't really seem to have much spark. I mean, they're basing their play around two wingers, Adam Johnson and James McLean. Against Newcastle in particular, I thought they were both very, very poor. Just Johnson is a very predictable player on the right. He always comes inside onto his left foot. And I think this season we're seeing really why Mancini didn't take to him at City. I guess he was the biggest signing of alongside Fletcher. I mean, that was almost a kind of Downing and Carroll combination, in the sense that one's intended to supply the crosses and one's intended to score, but while Fletcher is doing his job, Johnson I'm very rarely impressed by.
Oh dear. All right then. Well,
they're very slow as well.
True. Sunderland.
Yeah, really ponderous on the ball. And
are you worried?
No, not yet.
All right.
Not yet.
Okay. Wigan West Ham. Last time these two teams faced each other, Avram Grant was fired before he could get on the bus. Where is he now, Avram? Anybody? He's in Belgrade, says producer Ben. West Ham are up in seventh place. How about that, eh?
Yeah, Allardyce knows the terrain, doesn't he? It's no real surprise. They were always likely to be the best of the promoted sides, mainly because of him.
Right. Super stuff. Newcastle will be welcoming back Steve Clark, Barry, who's now with West Brom, of course, but did once manage a game for Newcastle after Ruud Gullit got the bullet.
Which rhymes.
It does. And he lost it 5-1 to Manchester United. Could he, perhaps, now have a victorious afternoon of management at St James's Park.
He could very easily.
Yeah, thanks for that. But I think. No, sorry.
That's just rude.
It is. It is. It is.
You just cut me off in order to criticise me for not elaborating when I was about to elaborate.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do elaborate, Barry.
On the balance of form, West Brom are the better side. All Newcastle right. haven't been playing well this season. It will be interesting to see how West Brom bounce back from last week's sort of heartbreaking Celtic against Barcelona-style defeat at the hands of Manchester City. Mm. And it will be an interesting reflection on his management style. How good a motivator is he? How good is he at picking them off the floor? Because they must have been devastated after that game last week.
Right. Absolutely. I fancy West Brom for this one.
It's quite interesting how Clark's using his two strikers. He's got Long and Lukaku. Generally only plays one of them. And from post-match interviews, he seems to regard whoever he starts as having a bit of a donkey job, you know, a difficult shift. And the player coming on is the one who's up against a knackered defence and who can run riot, which is odd because you'd expect the players to want to start. But he seems to think that the substitute role is more desirable.
Interesting.
Which is interesting. Also, in view of Dzeko, I was thinking this in the week. I mean, everyone's saying Dzeko should start and would want to start, but actually, it's an incredibly important role to be a specialist sub. You saw it with Solskjaer and Sheringham. Dzeko clearly has it. And there's a hell of a lot of glory to be had if you're a sub. More goals are scored in the last 15, when Dzeko's already scored some really important goals for City as a sub. So I think we underplay the importance, particularly of a striker in football.
Hmm. We underplay the importance of a
substitute striker, someone who actually has specific skills for that role.
Barry, you said that on Monday, but producer Ben axed it from the show.
I think so.
Yeah, rotten old producer Ben. Spurs, Southampton, Gareth Bale should be back for this game against his former club. Of course, Southampton are now on their third keeper of the season. That's not good, is it? We did kind of cover this, the fact that they've conceded more goals than anybody in the history of the Premier League at this point. And somebody said, well, they've done well to come up two divisions and that. And they're not going to get very much out of this game, are they?
It's unlikely. I mean, Spurs score a lot. Southampton concede a lot. Mm. Do the maths.
You do the math.
I think Southampton's big problem is maybe not the goalkeeper, the fact they don't defend in wide positions at all well. And against Bale and Lennon and a side very much based around width, you'd think that Tottenham would score at least a couple of goals there.
Sounds reasonable. Now, the big game that we haven't mentioned yet, Rob, is Everton-Liverpool. Liverpool? Have won, just before you say anything about this, have won 5 of the last 7 derbies.
Yeah, I think Everton have a mental block with Liverpool. We saw it at Wembley or wherever it was in the FA Cup semi-final. Throughout Moyes' time, there have been derbies that Everton have gone into as the better team, the form team, and played really meekly. So I think this is a really, this will be really instructive as to how far they've come in the last few months.
Mm.
I think Liverpool will win.
Do you?
Yeah, I think Liverpool are playing really well, but mainly because I think Everton do have this problem playing them.
Right.
I was at the semi-final that Rob mentioned, and it was a...
Where was it, for a start?
It was at Wembley.
Okay, good. Yep.
And it was a classic Merseyside derby in the sense that it was horribly scrappy and there was no real quality. And I thought two of the better players were, surprisingly, Darren Gibson and Jay Spearing, because they were just happy to put their foot on the ball, play it sideways, keep it simple and build the pressure. And now Liverpool have players, particularly Joe Allen, who can do that. And I think it'll be really important that, for both sides actually, just to have someone controlling the midfield and setting the tempo and trying to establish superiority rather than, you know, steaming into tackles.
Mm. One or two key absences potentially for Everton. I did hear word that Fellaini might be back for this game, but...
Pienaar will be suspended, which is a great shame for Everton because his partnership with Baines is excellent down the left.
All right, Barry, you want to chuck in anything there?
No, not really. Everton are scoring a lot at home.
Yep.
And would sort of suggest they might win. I would, if I was having a bet, I'd bet on a draw.
There you go. Would you bet on a sending off?
Yes.
All right then.
And I think discipline could be key in this. I mean, Rob's point about Everton being a bit meek in derbies is interesting, but if they do turn up, it could get very full-blooded, as we know, and whichever team keeps their heads.
I don't mean meek in terms of challenges and stuff. I just mean meek when they're in possession of the ball.
Mm.
But you're right, yeah, there's invariably trouble and lots of cards in that fixture.
All right. Wow, that's the Premier League weekend in prospect. It does sound like a particularly enticing round of fixtures. Some big games, of course, around Europe as well. I myself will be presenting Olympique Marseille against Lyon. big clash of French powerhouses in Ligue 1 Sunday night on ESPN. You might want to join me for that.
Is Joey Barton still suspended?
Yes, he is, Barry. Yes, he is. But still make his presence felt there.
Yeah.
Barry, you, of course, enjoyed James Horncastle's telly debut last week.
Yeah, it was good. You should have consulted each other beforehand, though, because you were both wearing black jackets and white shirts.
Well, he wore a blue shirt.
Blue jacket then.
No, black jacket, blue shirt. It was slightly blue. It was studio lighting, probably.
All right, I thought it just looked a bit funereal.
Right, did it?
Yeah.
When are we going to see you on, Buzz?
Oh, God, don't hold your breath. Right. Apparently, Eamon Dunphy had a complete meltdown about Mancini last night on RT. Now, I haven't heard it, but I believe he referred to him as a clown. And the presenter said, I'm not hugely comfortable with you here, Eamon, calling, you know, a respected Italian football manager a clown. And, what are you worried about? It's just television.
Well, so very, very right. That brings us to the end of today's Football Weekly. I'll be back with a newspaper review on Friday morning of what the Continental Press made of this midweek Champions League round. In the meantime, many thanks to producer Ben, Rob Smythe, Michael Cox and Barry Glendening. Have a super weekend. We'll be back on Monday.
Hi, I'm Simon Hattonstone. I'm a Guardian journalist, and I occasionally write books that are not read by many people. Let me tell you about some of the great advice from those who really know how to do it. Top name authors that you can read in a new Guardian book called Write. It's brilliant. Funny, perverse, bonkers and wise. If it sounds like writing, then I rewrite, says Elmore Leonard. There's Anne Enright for despairing writers. Remember, the first 12 years are the worst. So, don't put off that dream of winning the Booker Prize any longer. Get inspired by our new Guardian book, Write. You can get yours for half price, £6.50, using promo code PODCAST. To order, visit guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Anytime up to the end of October.